Good evening and welcome to Editing Aloud. Of all the scandals we have talked about on this program, there is none to match this week's sandpaper gate, the ball tampering scandal that has seen three members of the Australian cricket team sent home. Rob, this is kind of absolutely blatant cheating. How does a cricket team do this in this day and age?
Yeah, I think it's amazing that they didn't believe they'd get caught, given that there were cameras focusing on all the players all the time. It is bizarre. It's sort of like if a camera followed the Gupta brothers around for the last 4 years and they still did what they did. I mean, it takes some staggering chutzpah to do that and still expect to get away with it. But I do think fundamentally there is cheating, which is trying to change the condition of the ball, which a lot of players have done over the years. And then there is throwing matches like Hansi Kroonier did. And I think that there's a different level of criminality involved in both.
And what's the distinction?
Are you accusing them?
Clearly, when you throw matches, that's a criminal, that's a fraud, and that's different. I think this is just cheating. This is looking to get an advantage.
It's just cheating.
There is a quantum difference between throwing a match and deceiving thousands of viewers and cheating in the level they did it.
Have you seen no difference between match fixing
and actually tampering with the ball on camera?
It's both cheating. It's a different forms of cheating. It's the same thing. I mean, I thought there was a couple of fascinating things about this, which people haven't really spoken about. The one is, you know, if we believe the investigation as it's happened up to now, there were only three people involved, right? So it was the captain, the vice captain, and
the culprit, the one he was doing at Bancroft.
And that's very like, you know, organizations that make very bad decisions are always the most senior people. You know, if they had gone to the Australian side generally and said, listen, we're in a tight spot here, let's cheat. You know, somebody in the Australian team, several people, I would guess, would say no. You know, careful now. Let's not go down that road. but you know, I do think that it's very similar to a lot of organisations where, you know, where there's a little coterie that gets together informally, and then they informally decide, you know, and they don't tell anybody else. And you could tell there was tension in the Australian team.
The bowlers are very upset by the fact that
they've been in on it.
The bowlers cannot be upset. They're in on it. They want their ball to reverse swing and bowl outside. Yeah,
I think a lot of people on the team, it's like Tim says, they don't want to be part of a team that is cheating. So I think, you know, that's why they didn't take it to the whole group, because there were people who would have said no to it.
I think the entire team. I think if you're a bowler, you're like a Stark or any of the top bowlers there, you know they're going to help you with that ball. So the ball swings, reverse swings. Exactly. Who was benefiting from the ball changing the...
For sure, the bowlers, but that was an unfair advantage. Yeah. Another thing
it's like Michael Stark obviously was bowling much better than what he thought, saying, that he thought like he was bowling.
It's like Lance Armstrong. They knew what they were doing. They were doing it's a last
Rob,
joking.
So what it made me immediately think of was the previous week, I think, we had one of the Australian politicians saying that visas for South Africans would be fast-tracked because now they could come to this kind of civilised country. And I wondered if there was... you know, a reflection here of a sort of an attitude to South Africa, which is, you know, well, we can get away with anything there.
Yeah, true. Well, I mean, this has been a heated contest as well, but it was almost, I was just happy there was Australians for once, but Australians have always been held up as this vanguard of sporting prowess, and South Africans, ball, rugby, cricket, always seem like the dirty cousin. So I was happy to see the ugly side of Australia, but it is there. I mean, this is, and it's always, and I don't know, for me it was, for the past 30 years, I always watched cricket. The Australian team has been this dominant force. So for me, I was like, maybe for the past 20 years, how much has gone into this? So I was just happy to see the ugly side of Australian society as well.
And but you know, there is more to it than this, because, you know, the problem with cricket is that there are a couple of countries who play a lot of cricket, take it very seriously. It's a big sport in the countries, Australia, India, and UK.
And UK.
And there's a whole bunch of other countries who also play it, but on a much lesser scale, of which we are sort of one. You know, maybe the top end of that. Mm. The problem is that if in that disparity, so they are making all the money. Mm. So those three countries are making all the money. All the power over the over the institution of cricket. So the problem is that if they, in order to maintain that position, they've got to win. Yeah. They just have to win. One of the, you know, those three teams have to be, you know, within
to justify
in the
their
top
standing.
Five yeah. of the, you know, in order to justify the enormous amount of money that they are, that, you know, that the whole back room, you know, the advertising and the television and the, you know, sort of. So I think they are putting enormous pressure on their teams, enormous pressure, much more than we are, you know, on their teams to win. In fact, we are like very happy to.
So there is a lesson here, if you like, for corporates that if you sort of heavily incentivize success in a particular way, the chances that somebody cheats are certainly there, and you've got to be careful. And this brings us perhaps doing a reverse seek to Steinhoff, Rob.
And institutional comparisons are immense. I mean, you look at Steinhoff, you look at the fact that nobody believes Marcus Eurster or Cameron Bancroft in the Australian case was doing it by themselves. And in that case, it's been sold to people that fundamentally it was just Marcus Eurster doing it. He's the guy who's taken the flak. The board has gone to the parliamentary hearings and said, we knew nothing, including Christo Visser, which people find quite hard to believe, justifiably, I think. In this case, it was revealed that actually the coach might not have known, but the captain certainly knew and the vice-captain knew.
But we know the coach knew. Like, it cannot be at leadership committee. You're telling me those
so the
three
coach,
only
the
ones?
So the Christo Visser.
But Rob, we've now had Marcus Eurster refusing to come to Parliament to testify on the grounds, presumably, that he might incriminate himself, in fact. And at the same time, we've had the Steinhoff board, the new Steinhoff board, that is, awarding themselves some very rich pickings.
Is that justified? No, I think that, you know, what they argued in the proxy statement, which they sent out ahead of the AGM, which was on April the 20th, is that they should be allowed to pay themselves these extra sums of money. I think it's 7.4 million rand in all for three members of the board. Steve Boyson, Johan van Zyl, and Heather Son.
But those are old members,
yes, old members, yeah.
Yep,
That's an addition to the extra fees, just for all the hard work that they've put in. And I think what really will gall investors is that if they had put in harder work, then perhaps this might not have happened.
Indeed.
And investors have seen, you know, 100 billion rand, more than that, 200 billion perhaps, wiped off the value of their investment. Pension fund investors have seen their own investments taken a haircut. So in that context, to say that people who are already heavily incentivized should be paid more money for the hard work is a bit of an insult, I think. It'll be difficult for them to justify that at the AGM, which is coming up.
These are the people under whose watch the whole disaster happened. I mean, should they be getting anything at all?
Yes, no. Totally. I mean, this is... you know, it may be that, you know, that they are, you know, that when the class action lawsuit happens, you know, they might end up, you know, negative, even with this extra boost. This is the irony of the thing, because I mean, I just don't know. I'm intrigued about Steinhoff, how the legal situation unfolds. So you're a company. You say to your shareholders that. You can't justify your accounts that you signed off on. I mean, you're liable, right? Aren't you? I mean,
in this case, they blamed Christo Visser made a big deal in Parliament of blaming Deloitte, auditors, saying we relied on Deloitte for this. And Deloitte's taken a lot of flack. The inquiry began into the handling of African Bank in the last week.
Yes.
And they'll face another inquiry almost certainly for what happened at Steinhoff.
Yeah, but they were also the whistleblowers in this case, as far as we can tell. Mm. But still, I mean, you know, but obviously it's not justified. I would lay odds that they're not going to get this through anyway.
I mean, technically, in governance terms, is the board not responsible for the financial statements?
Yes, they are.
The board hires the auditors. Yes, it's not the auditors who are responsible, even though they too should have exercised oversight.
Exactly. This is the board, and it's funny enough, the chair, the new interim chair was the head of supervisory, so she was actually supposed to be looking after this whole thing as it happened. And so I agree with everyone. There's no way that they should just. I don't know how you can justify this extra payment for them when they didn't do the job in the first place. So it'll be interesting to see how it pays out on April the 20th, I understand.
It has raised all sorts of questions about the role of the board and the role of governance. And it's quite an international discussion that's going on now, not only related to Steinhoff, but in the UK to Carillion, which went down. I mean, what have we learned, if you like, Tim, about what a board should be looking out for?
Well, you know, this is very hard. I mean, you know, the problem is that, you know, businesses are getting so large now. I mean, they are getting, you know, even Steinhoff. Now, I mean, Steinhoff, you know, isn't, in international terms, you know, a mega retailer. It's big, you know, But they had operations in what was it? Half a dozen Europe, countries. You when you're sitting in the board and you have a well-known a high achiever founder CEO sitting across from you saying everything is fine. You know, it's very hard to sort of to second guess.
Having Elon Musk. Can you imagine being a board with Elon Musk? And he's doing all these things. You must somehow...
And somehow say...
Squeeze into Elon Musk's story. But this is Elon Musk.
But that's what they're Rob.
I do think that in this case, the board members might have been deceived by the materiality of what this was. So in Europe, these were small entities where the fraud happened. And they must have thought, even if it did look a bit dodgy, it's a tiny part, it's a fraction of our business. In terms of materiality, let's rather look at Mattressland in the US, which is taking up far more of our time, and Conforama in France and Europe. And they would have seen that and thought, well, perhaps this doesn't quite make sense, but it's a tiny part of our business. So I think it's made them rethink materiality in terms of the outsized impact that can then have on the bottom line. The fraud happened in a small part of the company, but that has had an outsized impact on the entire group.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing that they've, apart from the obvious things, you've always got to be suspicious if you have a, powerful CEO who's sort of guiding the discussion, and but you also have to have real expertise in that particular business, not in the sector.
I wonder about CEOs creating the boards for them. So they're almost like the CEOs. Build a board around their own tastes, their friends, or anyone who's almost vouched for by Rob and so on.
I didn't vouch for anyone.
So like diversity here comes into question. Maybe diversity is good for this one particular reason, that it stops having CEOs with these chums around him deciding a fate of a company and playing these games. And then we'll just trust what Rob says. We all play cricket with him on Saturday and Sunday, and we know his wife, we know whatever. So, but maybe
if you
hopefully
play cricket with me, you'll know not to trust.
Oh, maybe that's true. But hopefully that breaks that whole thing.
Evidence is that diversity makes for better financial performance by companies and does prevent that kind of clubbiness.
Yes, in this case, Christopher's son and his son Justa in the same. Talking about horses, whatever they were talking about, and then by the way, there's these results. Oh, there's some funnies there, but don't worry about it. Okay, we go. Yeah.
We've got 1 minute to go to the ad break, but reflections on SOE boards, because both Eskom and SAA with their new boards were in Parliament this week. Now, I have people saying, isn't it great? The problem's kind of solved. They have new fantastic boards. Mm. Is the problem solved at Eskom or SAA?
No. No. I mean, structurally, governance-wise, for our confidence, looks a bit better, but Eskom, SAA, SAA will only get fixed if it's a huge
structural
intervention. And if they got a CEO, a turnaround CEO, I don't quite trust this the current CEO. Nope, I don't know him at all, but I need a turnaround guy, a guy to go there and really be allowed to cut as much as possible.
And I'm going to leave it there. We'll be back after the break.
Yeah.
Welcome back. A week ago, we were worrying about a Moody's downgrade to South Africa's rating. A week later, what we have is, in fact, not an upgrade, but an upgrade to the outlook. Moody's has affirmed South Africa at investment grade and moved our outlook from negative to stable. At the same time, rival Standard & Poor's has doubled its projected growth rate on South Africa. So, Sikonati, are we looking at a sort of a virtuous cycle now where we have better growth and better ratings?
We are basically where we were in 1994-95, when we were starting all over again, just breaking into investment grade, and on and up we did go, and hopefully we are going back there. And you can't imagine the speed with which this has happened. The 3 months of Ramaphosa as president of the ANC, and as Moody's did say indeed, this all stems from the actions that have been taken in the government, starting with neutralizing Eskom and putting the correct people in there. And you should see that happening with SAA as well, is in that category. Denel is starting to melt away the problematic board, and you're going to see people put in there, Prasa and all of them, Transnet. So this is it. The state institutions, the state-owned companies, being the enabler and the facilitator of the growth that we expect.
Okay, Ron, a lot of the emphasis in the Moody statement is about institutions. Are we seeing enough of a turnaround to actually lift the growth rate?
Yeah, like remember last year we spoke about look, a new guy at the helm of ANC and whether just changing heads of all these SOEs would that make a difference? And it does for now. Like so, we get this nice upswing of sentiment and actually, Ramaphosa, I must say, it surprised me about how much. There's so much activity around SOEs and other institutions that have given us a swell of belief. But I guess the hard work is still there. ESCOM is still not fixed. SAA still has hard questions to be asked. But at least for now, the sentiment has shifted. And Ramaphosa has done quite significantly well in 3 months, which scares me in a way. It's all about one political party change, and then suddenly the country looks. But anyway, it just tells the weighting of ANC to all our psyches, I guess.
But I suppose it also does emphasize the importance of institutions. Mm. And I wonder, Tim, do you think that the South African Revenue Service move, the suspension of Mr. Moyane, if there was any doubt, may have tipped it for them?
Yeah, you know, but I mean, I keep on saying this, and no one believes me. But you know, South Africa is 0.7% of the global economy. You know, and we have a global economy now that is growing all over the place by enormous leaps and bounds. I mean, India is growing faster than China. Europe is growing faster than America. You know, all of the metrics that were and South Africa's part of that. South Africa's part of this. Sort of global shift. I think the rating agencies, have been surprised by international global growth. And then they looked at all of the outliers of which we and I don't know, maybe kind of Mexico, possibly Brazil. Also Brazil, mm-hmm. are actually potentially very high beneficiaries. And they're worried now that they'll look like idiots. When we totally outperform their sort of miserable projections.
Actually, Rob, Standard & Poor's, I mean, the accusation has been made that they look a bit like idiots because they downgraded us again just before December. Mm. And yesterday, this week, we had them at their conference saying, oh, well, we've revised growth up, but just looks as kind of miserable as ever. I mean, do you think they're just trying to justify the downgrade they did to make themselves not look so silly, or were they right to downgrade into December?
Firstly, I want to say that I don't think that Tim said nobody believes him. I think what you said was perfectly reasonable. So but I do think that, what S&P said yesterday, as you reported, is that, it all looks better. To use a terrible cliche, the optics look a lot better. Mm. But fundamentally, there are issues still. Just because you changed Tom Moyane at SARS doesn't mean you're immediately dealing with a $50 billion revenue gap. You're not collecting taxes, your revenue is still in a shortfall. We still have various issues that still need to come to the party. You can change leadership. Yeah. But fundamentally, you still need to change what's actually happening structurally. So I think what they said is you need to wait and see. You can't just expect there to be an upgrade. And I think that's a reasonable position to take at this point.
Hanging over it is the whole question of expropriation without compensation. And this week has seen land invasions, not where some might have expected them on farms, but in the urban areas in Gauteng and the Western Cape. How much of a concern is that, Rob, and how much should we be concerned?
Well, I do think that it does illustrate the real key problem. As Carol Payton wrote in Business Day, it's fundamentally about one of the real issues is poverty. That is the issue. So people want land in urban areas close to jobs where they can actually earn money. So that's fundamentally one of the issues. We don't have jobs in this country. So urban areas that's what happens. We've had an explosion of urban settlements since 1994, actually. People want land near employment, near fundamentally that they can use. We do have, a tiny fraction of the land, I think it's 2.6%, is in urban areas. And that's the demand from people because that's what's going to actually fundamentally change their lives, not handing somebody a giant parcel of land in a rural area.
So, Konati, you took a very firm view in your column in the Financial Mail this week on the land issue. Do you want to spell it out?
Yes, absolutely. Look, the real truth of the matter is that all the land belonged to the people that your people found here in 1652 and beyond.
Hillary's people.
Hillary's people. Now, let's be blunt and call it what it is.
And we never
that
found.
Series of armed robberies over 300 years deprived black people of land. Of course, black people themselves were guilty of land of land theft from the Khoisan people. I'm talking about the Bantu, my people.
Come.
Now, the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa cut off the thing and said all land that was stolen by white people in from 1913 onwards can be claimed back. Anything beyond that, before that, which was the most violent period, it was a free gift to the European invaders who came in. The Land Rights Act, a Restitution Act of 1994, only limits that. Now, even that the government failed to execute. It failed to restitute 20% of the land that it said it would within the next 15, in the first 15 years. It failed dismally. To this day, they only talk about 4% of land in black hands, which is also, again, just a thumbsuck. The issue now, Ron and I, the black people in the middle classes and others, did manage to buy land when we acquired our middle class status. But the majority of black people are the ones that are invading farms because justice has not been done. Even though the Constitution in its preamble says we recognize the injustices of our past, no one made an attempt. Even when the government did agree to limit itself to only repatriating land that was stolen from 1913 onwards, it failed dismally to do that. That is my point in about the Land Act.
Now, just to shift topics a little bit, we say a very sad goodbye this evening to one Tim Cohen, who is retiring to the Karoo, from where he will, I hope, continue to file columns and copy for Business Day. Tim.
And he's retiring to a farm in the Karoo.
A farm in the Karoo.
Well, it's a non-farm. It's farmland, but there's, you know, you can't, I mean, it's been very interesting living in the Karoo, as I have in the past, in this farming area. It's a small community. There's a, you know, because there's, you can...
Tell people the farm that you refuse to lease me some land on.
Yes, no. And then Sicko is constantly talking about bringing his sheep and putting them on my land. And you know, I haven't said no, but I'm...
You have not said yes either.
Yes.
This is Tim's second last day at Business Day, right?
Last day.
Tim steps down from the editorship.
It's been great being on this program, by the way.
And I wanted you to reflect
We've had great fun on this program, and it's been a real treat being part of it. And I'm sorry I had so many ums along the way and forgot people's names, spoke the, you know, said the wrong thing.
You didn't finish your sentences.
I didn't finish my sentences. My wife says, you were buffering. You were just buffering.
You did write in your column this week about, you reflected on what it's been like to edit Business Day over the past 2 years, which have been a really tumultuous 2 years for South Africa and the role of journalists.
Yeah, no. I mean,
Please reflect on that time.
I mean, I really think that journalism in South Africa has had a moment over the past couple of years, and it's been fantastic to be part of it. But, you know, journalists in South Africa are, you know, have been, especially print journalists, this is a declining profession. We are fighting to, you know, bring out the same quality products with massively reduced resources that we did really as recently as 5 or 10 years ago. But that hasn't made it less fun. It's been great. I think we did change South African history a bit. Really, just by not by being ourselves, you know, being bringing a critical mind to bear on the issues of the day, and it's been, you know, really fantastic to have to be working with good people who, and we, you know, we differ about a lot of things, but on this issue, there was never any disagreement. We really wanted to be play a thoughtful, balanced but incisive role in what was happening in South Africa, and especially I think our group and some of the online platforms, the radio stations were there, but really though, it's been we did some really great journalism, and made it really impossible for the ANC to deny. You know, if you trace what the ANC said about corruption over the past 4 years, initially there was like they were talking about allegations of corruption. Mm-hmm. Then there was a stage where they were talking about perceptions of corruption, and then there was a point where they just said, okay, there's corruption. You know, and that's trajectory really was caused by very active politicians, some with really great, you know, some in very important NGOs, and some really top-notch journalism. So thank you all for having me.
We did get the media did get a special mention, in fact, in the Moody's ratings report, right? Mm. I mean, for standing up.
Yeah.
It's like speaking truth to power, if you like.
It has been.
Yeah, and you know, because of this situation, I'm going to seriously consider having some of Sika's sheep on my farm.
Let's be clear here. Tim is just looking for a black face to protect him from land invasions in the Karoo. But I will take the offer.
And before you go, Tim, we'd just like to drink a quick toast to your years at Business Day and your many years to come farming in the Karoo with Sika
Sheep. With
Sika
Sheep.
Run. I'll leave it to you to do the honors.
Here we go.
All right, we're all watching now.
Tim, absolute pleasure working with you.
Hey!
Well done.
There you go.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Oh, cool. You take your glasses, Sikonati. No, you're getting sheep. We organize your sheep.
That's all we have time for. Thank you very much for joining us. Please join us again next week for another edition of Editing Aloud.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.